KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, in addition to all of the other big stories that go on internationally, Washington, one of the perpetual crises that we have here in Southern California is traffic and the homelessness. And as you know, both on the county level and the city level, L.A. has passed Measure H and Triple H to deal with the homeless. But in Anaheim, the crisis is amazing. If you have not seen the video of the Santa Ana River Trail, we had it posted on our Facebook page. More than 11,000 citizens have signed a petition demanding that they get the National Recreation Site back. And it is a couple of bicyclists with GoPro cameras on their helmets made a ride through and posted the video. And it is a dystopian, hellish vision of our community that you have to see it to believe it. How many people are just living along this park waterway?
It's a full-on camp.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a mini city. It looks like a filthier version of one of those Syrian refugee camps. To talk to us about where we go from here, from the city of Anaheim, Councilwoman Chris Murray joins us. Good morning, Councilman Murray. How are you? Yeah, hello. Councilman Murray, how are you?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Now we got you loud and clear.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thanks for coming on with us. So we've seen the video that was recorded by a couple of bicyclists through the Santa Ana River Trail. It's really stunning. It's a shocking piece of video.
Yeah, it really is. We have a genuine human health crisis on the riverbed right now and in some of our other rights of way that border the city. And it is absolutely time for action. There's just an absolute need for all levels of government, local, state, and federal, to come together on this. And so I have called for the city council to declare a state of emergency and then mount a massive community triage to get services to those who need them and will accept them, but then also to follow up with total enforcement of our public spaces for the safety and security and health of all of our communities and those who live there.
How many people has there been a census taken of how many people are living in the Santa Ana River Trail? Because it looked like from the video that I saw that there's thousands, literally thousands of people camped out there.
Yeah, we know there are at least 1,000 in the Anaheim section, which is basically Chapman to Ball Road. But less than half of those, we believe, are actual Anaheim residents. It extends all the way down to Huntington Beach. So all of our communities in Orange County are grappling with this crisis right now. And so I'm hoping that with Operation HomeSafe, a program I've proposed to start with service and aid but follow up with fair warning and enforcement, that we can develop a model that other cities will follow, and by working together as local agencies, we can protect the entire river channel.
We're talking with Chris Murray, who's on the Anaheim City Council. The obvious question is, where do you put, let's take the 1,000 people who are in the Anaheim section, where does Anaheim have bed space for 1,000 people?
We would, the program I am proposing is literally this, the state of emergency would allow us to draw on all levels of government to pull together emergency shelter opportunities, and we will identify parcels and create the shelter and offer the shelter and then move and relocate those who are living in the riverbed to those locations, identify what their specific service needs are, and with the goal of getting them into permanent shelter and housing, or within specific programs that address their needs, whether they're a veteran, or emancipated minor, a person dealing with addiction or extraordinary financial and health needs. We want to make sure they get services they need. But beyond that, we've also got to provide for public safety and get the river trail remediated and returned to its intended purpose. And so it will be all the above. But yeah, we are going to have to create those shelters, and my proposal is aggressive. We're going to work within the next 30 to 60 days, if it's approved by my colleagues on September 12th, to do this.
If I remember correctly, a year or so ago, and all the time in my life has blurred together.
Mm-hmm.
But the city of Anaheim was having a problem at the library as well with homeless who were basically camping out in the library.
Yeah, so about 2014, the city actually put together a program with one of our nonprofit partners, CityNet, to identify service needs. And we're out there every single day with caseworkers and professionals that work with the homeless, talking with them, contacting them, finding out what their backgrounds are, what their needs are. And since 2014 with this program with CityNet, we have helped 800 individuals that were formerly homeless find housing or reconnect with family members. So the program's working. We have more coming in than we can, you know, find service for, just because, you know, the needs are so specific and individualized. That's why we've got to couple it with enforcement. So the other thing Anaheim did in 2014 is implement very stringent anti-camping ordinances in our city parks and public spaces, and that's been successful. So we haven't seen that reemerge in our city since 2014, that level of camping and loitering and congregation. But the River Channel is county property, and the county is working to build shelters and provide services. What I'm proposing is we match their effort and really double down, because, you know, we just can't allow this to proliferate any further. The level of MRSA virus and Hep C and the criminal activity that's existing down there, and as you've seen from the GoPro videos and those who are down there meeting with these individuals, it's a health crisis, not just for the surrounding communities, but for those living in these encampments. It is not compassion to enable that as a permanent way of life.
It certainly isn't. What kind of corporate partners are you finding in Anaheim? Because one of the things that I found most shocking about that video is that some of these homeless camps were literally 20 yards from the Big A sign at Anaheim Stadium. I mean, right in Disneyland's backyard.
And we saw little kid parks, like, through them, too.
So, you know, I can't imagine that the Walt Disney Company or the Angels or any of the major attractions in that part of Southern California are happy about having this blight and health risk right on their, you can't even call it back to it, it's on the front door.
Well, nobody's happy about it, and not because it's necessarily just about blight or aesthetics, it's because this is a human health crisis. There's no other way to phrase it, and everyone is justifiably concerned, our businesses large and small. I will say of the Angels, the Ducks, Disney, and our resort community as a whole, our largest charitable contributors to all of our organizations that help those in need, and particularly at-risk kids, and they give millions of dollars every year. So, you know, we rely on them quite a bit to help out, and I will be calling on them for support to ensure that this effort is successful as well, because it helps the entire community.
Why do you think your city has become such a focus for the homeless issue? I mean, it's certainly not exclusive to Anaheim, and L.A. is the homeless capital of North America, but Anaheim makes the news a lot on this front. And why do you think it is that Anaheim is particularly susceptible to this problem?
Well, I think we make the news probably more predominantly than many communities, because we are a worldwide destination. We have, you know, 20 plus million annual visitors. We're very visible. And let's face it, you know, the riverbed is great weather if you're not being disturbed and you choosing this way of life. It's one of the more ideal from a climate standpoint places to be. But the fact is, you know, it's not safe for the individuals, whether they choose it or whether they're there because of circumstances beyond their control. It is not compassionate, and it is not in their best interest to live this way. And we've got to help get them connected to services. And for those who refuse, we have to really enforce the law and say enough is enough. This is not a way of life that we will sustain. It is not lawful, and it is not in the public's best interest.
I'm really happy to hear you talk, to use the phrase, who choose to live this life, because there are people who, because of mental illness, untreated mental illness, and other personal issues, end up on the street. And I know that people have a hard time absorbing this, but there are people who literally make this choice. They have chosen to live, if you will, a feral lifestyle. And the thing is that I think our laws are inadequate to deal with it. And we've discussed this many, many times. There's been a lot of lawsuits, both at the local level and the national level, that have essentially tied the hands of local law enforcement and authorities to forcibly remove people and bring them into shelters under, you know, basically civil rights violations and, illegal detention. And I don't know. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a constitutional scholar. I don't know how to unscramble that. But I really do believe that we need to empower local authorities with more authority to remove people, especially people who have chosen to squat on public property.
Well, and that's what we've done with our anti-camping ordinance in Anaheim is really enforce the law that public spaces are there for everybody. We had before 2014, we had a situation that was really escalating in parks where children in little leagues and our soccer teams and kids just playing after school were, you know, finding needles in the swing sets and other things that I won't talk about on the radio.
Yeah,
this hour,
I know. We know what it is.
There is drug use and prostitution and disease that is putting everybody at risk. There is a criminal element as well that is preying on those that whether they choose or whether they're there beyond their control, there's a criminal element that does prey on them and is using these encampments as cover as well. So, you know, for all the above, we have absolutely got to take action now. And so I'm going to be calling on my colleagues on the Anaheim City Council, but then really looking to collaborate with our county officials and all of our neighboring cities to make this truly comprehensive. And I hope this model can be replicated up and down the River Channel, not just in Orange County, but in Riverside and L.A. County as well. This is a River Channel that feeds into the ocean, and all of this, you know, all of this impacts the groundwater and impacts debris flowing into the ocean. And let's not forget, we're seeing what's happening with Irma and Harvey and places around the country that are dealing with floods. But this is a flood channel. It's called a flood channel for a reason. And we had significant rain events last year. So there's that safety crisis looming as well. We've got to act before the rains come here as well.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it. We'll continue to follow the story along with you. Chris Murray from the Anaheim City Council. Appreciate you being with
us.
Thank you for helping us promote Operation Home Safe. We hope to see it replicated elsewhere, and I appreciate your time.
All right. Word came that for the second time in 2 years, Leslie Van Houten, who was convicted along with other Manson family gang members of the horrific slaughter of Leno and Rosemary LaBianca, back in 1969, was granted parole. And to talk to us about this and the Menendez trial, the different Menendez, not the Menendez brothers, Robert Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, it's a pleasure to welcome back to show the best in the biz, KBC's legal analyst, Royal Oaks. Good morning, Mr. Oaks.
Hey, thank you, Doug. Good morning to you.
So I imagine for people like Randy Wang, the Manson murders must sound like we're talking about the Civil War.
Pretty much.
Because it is a very long time ago. And, you know, is the 21st time that Leslie Van Houten has appeared before the parole board?
Yeah, exactly. 21. I mean, it's you know, every few years that she's back. And, of course, as you were just reporting, slightly different result this time.
And it will now go, if I've got this correctly, to the full parole board. And then if they recommend, as they did last year, parole for Leslie Van Houten, it goes to Governor Brown. Governor Brown last year vetoed it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's a little bit of a deja vu all over again. So she and all the other Manson gang folks, they've been asking for parole, you know, every few years for decades, and nobody has gotten out. One of them died in prison. Manson, of course, is still there. So finally, a year or so ago, Leslie Van Houten gets the big green light from the parole board. And we don't know if they thought, well, she's no longer a threat to society or she's reformed. You know, they say she's a model prisoner. She's gotten some college degrees. She was the youngest of the Manson gang. She was 19. But whatever led to it a year or so ago, they say, okay, you're out. But Governor Brown has the right to say, I don't think so. I'm vetoing it. And what he said last year was that he didn't see the explanation in terms of her response to questions and so on, is how she went from model teenager. She'd been like a homecoming queen and a cheerleader and so on, great grades, you know, great kid. from that to ruthless killer. He didn't see the explanation, so I think he was wondering about, you know, her motivation, her state of mind, and he wasn't really looking at the aspect of her youth and the passage of time, and, you know, is she really a threat to society now that she's around 70? So the difference now, though, Doug, is that there was a witness who came forward to say, okay, I was in the gang, I actually recruited Leslie, I don't feel good about it. But this witness said, you know, she felt totally terrified that she couldn't leave. She was really young. She felt she was trapped here. Now, a lot of people would say, excuse me, does that explain or excuse you admitting that you stabbed this couple in Los Feliz 12 times and so, you know, go back to prison? But apparently the board for 2 years in a row now feels that for whatever combination of factors, they should let her out. Now, Governor Brown, who knows if he took seriously the fact that I think there were 140,000 signatures on a petition last year saying to the governor, do not let her out, and he didn't. So now ball is in his court. He can either just make the decision or he can send it to the full parole board and let them look at it again.
By the way, I signed a petition this morning that Sharon Tate's sister has circulated yet again to try to prevent this, what I would believe would be miscarriage of justice. You know, it's a good thing for Leslie Van Houten I'm not on the parole board, because I just don't care that she has expressed remorse and that I don't care she has 100 college degrees. And I don't care that she was 19 years old. How old do you have to be to know that you don't slaughter someone in their beds?
Yeah, I think most people agree with that.
Repeatedly plunged knives into somebody. And it, even assuming that her remorse is sincere, it's irrelevant that once you have made a decision to slaughter somebody, you don't get a mulligan. You don't get to resume your life even after having lost all those years behind bars.
You can rot in jail.
You just stay there. You just stay there. In fact, to me, the moral choice for Leslie Van Houten, if she's really remorseful for what she did, she should say, I have forfeited my right to freedom and will stay here until my last breath. And that is my penance for the horrible thing I did to the LaBianca family. To lawyer up and to year after year after year to try to get out of jail, to me, negates whatever actual regret and remorse she has for the horrific and unspeakable crime she committed.
And you mentioned Sharon Tate's sister, the families of the victims. Obviously, it's just got to be so incredibly stressful for them.
Year after year to have to go through this, right.
Vilification and threats and so on, and yet the courage they showed to keep trudging up to those hearings and putting together the petitions. So it's just a tragic situation all around.
It really is. Well, we'll see what happens. Jerry Brown was the goalie last time, and correctly bounced it back. Let's hope the parole board bounced it back, but it's likely that it will end up on the governor's desk again. Shifting gears to the state of New Jersey. The senator, Robert Menendez, I totally forgot about this. It's been so long since charges were originally filed, but Robert Menendez is on trial now for corruption. And it's never a good sign, by the way, when the judge tells your lawyer to shut up. And that's exactly what the district court judge
did. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. It is funny. It's been so long, about 2 years since they indicted him. And there were obviously all sorts of pretrial skirmishing. And the fact that he's a sitting United States senator, you know, a huge deal. He's obviously lawyered up at Abbey Lowell, one of the top criminal defense lawyers and white-collar lawyers in the nation. So, but the story you allude to, I mean, talk about a bad first day. Here was the deal. The lawyer for Senator Menendez is saying to the judge, oh, Your Honor, you know, it's so important that the senator take part in critical votes in the United States Senate. We'd like the trial to be in recess on a few days when these really important votes are coming up. And so the judge responds by saying, you know what, pal? The only reason for your motion is to try to impress the jury with how important the senator is. So here's a big no. You're not going to get a recess. The reaction by the lawyer to that was, well, Your Honor, you're speculating our motives. This is terrible. And they basically get into a shouting match with each other, and they're talking over each other. And, you know, as you know, from times you've been in court, the court reporter can't do it. You know, she's waving her arms. I can't take down two people talking at once. And so as they're talking over each other, the judge says to the lawyer, shut up for a moment if you don't mind. So that's got to be a bad start. I mean, I was thinking of the movie My Cousin Vinny, you know, with the public defender who can't quite get the words out. I would think maybe Senator Menendez would want Joe Pesci at this point instead of on the very first day for the judge to be yelling at his lawyer to shut up. But the, you know, the issue in the trial is the senator enjoyed 7 years of a life of luxury, $700,000 in gifts, private flights, luxury accommodations, free vacations, all from this really wealthy businessman and ophthalmologist who was a longtime friend of the senator's. But the prosecution's theory is, no, this isn't just about friendship. This is about bribery, because this wealthy doctor had business interests.
It was like X-ray machines for airport security, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, there's that. Plus, there are medical billing issues. Plus, there are overseas things. There was the Dominican Republic issue. And so repeatedly, according to the prosecution, the senator is having meetings with Medicare and Medicaid. He's dealing with the Assistant Secretary of State on port security in the Dominican Republic. The doctor's got a bunch of financial interests down there. So it's always a challenge for the government in this kind of situation to establish a link between the gift and the action, because, I mean, let's face it, you know, we've heard from the lobbyist Abramoff and others explain, you know, this is just legalized bribery, what we have right now. Businesses and individuals who are wealthy, they give lots of money to politicians, and the politicians then go out and vote and behave in a certain way. And you can't claim that every single action of a company or an industry paying money to a politician is bribery just because down the road there was a favorable act by the politician. But here, you know, the government thinks that they've got the guy. But the defense has their side of the story. They're going to say basically it's friendship, long-time friendship, and so there was no evil motive here.
Weren't there also allegations that this was a political indictment because Menendez had gone against the Obama administration on a vote, on a critical vote?
Yeah, that's true. There was a big feud between President Obama and Senator Menendez, and the senator claimed that the whole investigation got going because this is a federal deal in federal court with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Menendez said, well, this is payback by the Obama administration for all of the stuff that I did that the president didn't like. So it's hard to know whether the defense is going to be able to get that into evidence. I think instead what they're probably just going to be trying to establish is a long-time friendship and so on. But the government's got the fact that Menendez allegedly lied on his financial disclosure forms. And when you have such a clear link in terms of a short time frame between the gifts, you know, 700 grand with the hotels and the vacations and so on.
Yeah, I don't have any friends, by the way, who are doing that for me.
Well, you just need to get elected to the United States Senate, and I bet you'd become even more popular than you are now.
Hasn't America suffered enough, Royal? By the way, speaking of that, this is kind of interesting. Senator Cory Booker, the other senator from New Jersey, has been sitting front row in court as a show of support. And I wonder if this trial starts to go sideways, how quickly Cory Booker is going to be unavailable for a court appearance.
Well, you know, it's interesting that there might be just a personal friendship between the two of them, but you're right. I mean, a politician kind of runs a risk of being tarred by the same brush.
Sure.
If he is associated with the guy, because, I mean, as you say, if the jury comes back and convicts him, the voters may remember that Booker was there associated with him.
Exactly.
And Menendez, you know, he's not the most sympathetic character. I think Booker's probably more popular back there than he is.
Hey, listen, Royal, as always, thank you, sir. RoyalOaks.com for all things Royal. That's Oaks with an E, and we appreciate it. We'll talk to you down the line.
Thank you.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
Not fake news. With $1,000, you could help save the Hawaiian monk seal from extinction. Or you could just go to Hawaii for the Mai Tais. Your shot at $1,000 four times a day starts a week from today. 4K a day on KLOS. Details at 955KLOS.com. And if you're in need of some fast cash, call Loan Me at 855-59-PRIME. Restrictions may apply.
Fall is the best time to feed your lawn. With 10% off Scott's Turf Builder Winter Guard Fall Weed and Feed and Fall Lawn Food at the Home Depot. Scott's Turf Builder Winter Guard feeds your lawn to build strong, deep grass roots for winter when you need it most. So it'll be lush, green, and beautiful next spring when you want it most. Scott's Turf Builder Winter Guard Fall Weed and Feed and Fall Lawn Food. 10% off now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Valid through October 4th.
If you could get rewarded for sleeping, would you? What about for sitting on a bench, looking out at the ocean? Or for sitting in a comfy chair, watching football on TV? Guess what? That third dream job is real thanks to Buffalo Wild Wings. You can come in, watch football, and earn points with blazing rewards just for being there. That's right. You're a professional football fan now. Brag about it to all your friends. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings. Beer. Sports.
Terms and conditions apply. Must be a Blazin' Rewards member. To join in for details, visit BlazinRewards.com or download the Blazin' Rewards app.
Wouldn't you love to go minutes across town to hit the casino instead of traveling hours across the desert? Wouldn't it be great if you could play real blackjack and poker right here in L.A.? Stop in at Hustler Casino and see for yourself why it's not what you expect and everything you love. Real casino, real cash, real close. Play real blackjack, poker, and no collection easy baccarat 24 hours a day. And it's just minutes across town. Just 15 minutes from downtown L.A. Hustler Casino, where it pays to play. Must be 21. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Now shopping for your family can earn you free gas.
Fill her up, Mom!
That's because you can use Plenty Points to save money on Synergy Fuel at participating Exxon and Mobil stations, the exclusive gas partners of the Plenty Rewards program. You'll get $2 in savings on gas for every 200 Plenty Points you redeem. How great is that? So download the Plenty app and activate bonus fuel offers from Exxon and Mobil today.
Way to go, Mom!
Total amount of savings depends on points earned. Maximum of 2,500 points per gas purchase. See Plenty.com for details.
AutoZone presents Peak Performance. Maximizing fuel economy, engine life, and overall performance doesn't take a lot. Thanks to fuel treatment and fluids from AutoZone. Right now, you can save $4 on 16 ounces of Seafoam motor treatment for only $7.99. So visit your local AutoZone. With over 275 Greater Los Angeles locations, the right supplies and good advice are just around the corner. Let's get you what you need. See store for restrictions and details.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
The fallout continues. Reaction over the president's announcement that he was terminating the DACA program but giving Congress 6 months to fix the problem, quote unquote, fix the problem. He didn't define what fixing the problem includes. To me, fixing the problem starts with fixing the border. That until we have secured borders and internal enforcement, including some way of trafficking and policing who comes into the country through airports, we're kidding ourselves. It doesn't matter what laws we pass. Because if you don't have control of your borders, you don't have control of your immigration system, and therefore whatever laws you pass are irrelevant. But this is obviously a highly emotional issue, and no place more so than here, because not only does California have more DREAM Act kids than any other place in the country, but L.A. County has the vast preponderance of Dreamers within the state of California. To talk to us about this right now is a spokesman for FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, Ira Melman. Ira, how are you?
Good. Good morning, Doug.
Ira, we had a conversation yesterday with longtime Democratic strategist Gary South, and it was interesting because, A, he agreed to come on with us, which is unusual. It's very hard to get folks from the other side to come on AM talk radio and talk with us. And, B, trying to wrestle him to the ground on this issue is tough because everybody is in partisan warrior mode, and particularly with this president. Nobody, certainly on the other side of the aisle, wants to give Donald Trump a half a chance to have any kind of a success. And I get it. You know, Mitch McConnell sort of made that tactical blunder many years ago when he said our goal is to make Barack Obama one-term president and deny him everything. But with that said, I believe that we have an historic opportunity to actually fix our broken immigration system, and the time is right now. But we have to have somebody to do a deal with. And the obvious deal to me is, an amnesty for the DREAM Act kids in exchange for genuine, real, and lasting border security. That's the obvious deal. But I don't know that it's possible if we don't have anybody to make a deal with.
It is the obvious deal. In addition to border security, universally verified
look, nobody promised the DACA recipients anything. President Obama said this program might not outlast his administration. And he was right. It hasn't outlasted his administration. The American public has been promised secure borders. They've been promised that their jobs are not going to be taken by illegal aliens. They've been promised a whole load of things. Every one of those promises was broken to the American public. It is time to ensure that the American public gets what they deserve out of our immigration policy. Then we can figure out what to do with these unique groups of illegal aliens who might deserve more consideration than the general illegal alien population. The Democrats are digging their heels in. Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leadership, they've called press conferences. They're insisting on a Clean Dream Act. They don't want to give up anything in exchange for amnesty for illegal aliens. Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, they've been mostly silent on this. The White House has been silent. The president said, you know, come back to me in 6 months and show me what you have. He needs to show some leadership. You know, give me a bill that has A, B, C, and D, and then we'll talk about the Dream Act. But so far we haven't had that, and there's a obvious paucity of leadership coming out of Washington.
No, this will be a moment in time that you can circle on the calendar if we blow it and look back for generations with regret, because this is a golden opportunity. It's an irony. The night before last, on Tuesday night, I went to see Hamilton out here in L.A. And one of the big moments in the musical Hamilton is when, of course, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison went behind closed doors and they brokered a deal that created modern America. The capital was located in Washington, D.C., and in exchange, Jefferson agreed to support Hamilton's fiscal plan for the United States, and modern America was born. That's what we need. We need President Obama and Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan to go behind closed doors with Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer and broker a deal where we look at the entire immigration system and say, right now, we've got a president who's willing to take the heat to fix our broken borders. And you have things that you want to achieve, and we can do all of it at once if we're willing to drop dogma and stop trying to score cheap political points and put our cards face up on the table. We want the Dream Act kids who committed no sin, were carried into this country, some of them at a very young age, to have an opportunity to go as far in life as their talents and luck will take them and contribute to society to their maximum potential. But what we want to make sure is that we're not rewarding the lawbreakers, their parents who brought them in illegally, and encourage millions of more people to follow suit so that they can get in line for another amnesty. And the only way to make that happen is to make sure we have a border barrier and interior enforcement. And the Democrats will say, and President Obama, former President Obama, in his press release calling President Trump's decision cruel, he put the usual boilerplate disclaimer in the lead paragraph that we all support secure borders, but there's no evidence of it. And here's the opportunity to put up or shut up. If you actually believe in border security, then let's see it. Let's see it now, because here's the opportunity. You can get something that you have dreamed of, but it's time to stop dreaming and time to start acting. Forget if you want to talk about the Dream Act, act now. But we have to have somebody to do a deal with.
Right. And, you know, President Trump, the Republican leadership, they need to put their cards on the table. Tell Chuck Schumer, tell Nancy Pelosi, this is what we're going to expect. If you guys want some consideration for the people who have DACA status, then we are going to need, you know, as you said, secure borders. We're going to need universal E-Verify. We're going to need an end to these sanctuary policies. But right now, what the Democrats are doing, they've even stopped pretending to support any kind of immigration enforcement. Just a few years ago, when the Gang of Eight bill was out there, Chuck Schumer was saying this is the strongest enforcement bill in history. You know, we all support it. Of course, we knew he wasn't telling the truth. But now they're not even willing to pretend anymore. What they're saying is we want amnesty for the illegal aliens, and it cannot come with any strings attached. No border security, no interior enforcement. We just want the amnesty. And, of course, that's a non-starter. At least we hope it's a non-starter. So what we need from the Republicans is their list of demands. The Democrats have presented their list of demands. Now let's see what the Republicans want in exchange.
We're talking with Ira Melman, is with the FAIR, Federation for American Immigration Reform. Their website is fairus.org. And I agree. This is where this is really, to me, the make or break moment for Trump's presidency. Of all the campaign promises that he made, the one that electrified his supporters was build the wall, which I never took specifically as a literal promise. I took it as an umbrella promise that he was going to be tough and get immigration reform that started with border enforcement. And if he punts this, if he just leaves the ball in Congress's hands and he doesn't actually roll up his sleeves and do the hard work that's going to be necessary, and it is hard work. This is going to be really hard work because you're going to ask Democrats to stray off of the ideologically pure reservation that they've been planted on for decades now, and they're going to disappoint some activists and radicals in their midst. For instance, Dianne Feinstein, Senator Dianne Feinstein, has already done so. When she spoke yesterday and correctly talked about DACA being on shaky legal ground.
DACA was executive order. Legal is the law of passage of something. There are 10 attorneys general that are prepared to sue. I don't want to get into that. The point is DACA is here.
Well, your answer indicates, though, that it's on shaky legal ground.
It is. That's why we need to pass a law.
Okay, so there you've got Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, who is acknowledging that, look, DACA, as instituted by President Obama, was on shaky legal ground. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said it was unconstitutional, and that's been the law of the land since. So let's use that window of opportunity to fix the problem, but it's going to require leadership. And so far, I mean, President Trump didn't even go out and make the announcement himself. He sent Jeff Sessions out to do it. That scares me. That means, is he going to bail on this the way he bailed yesterday on the debt ceiling?
Very likely. I'm not quite sure what he is thinking. Nobody's quite sure what's going on in the West Wing. I mean, actually, Jeff Sessions understands this far better than I think anybody else in this country. Maybe he was the right guy to do it. But we need some leadership. You know, there is a consensus in this country. People want our border secured. They want interior enforcement to prevent people from getting jobs if they come to the United States illegally. They also do have some sympathy for this group of people who were brought to the country as children. The 85-90% of the public would probably agree on all of these things. And instead, what we're going to do is let a few radical fringe groups dictate from the entire country. And, you know, that only happens because the leadership allows them to do that. As you said, you know, we did what Jefferson and Hamilton did, that they went behind closed doors and came to some kind of consensus and told the 10 or 15% on the fringes where they could go. I think most Americans would be very happy with that deal.
Agreed. And if this opportunity is bungled, I don't know when another opportunity will arise or if it will even matter at that point. And again, you know, politician after politician after politician in this city and in this state, when pressed, most of the time, they don't even pay lip service to border security. But when they do, they usually only talk about sanctioning employers. But when you actually push for even E-Verify being universally applied, they don't want that either, because they understand that if people in the country illegally can't work, they can't make contributions, they can't, they become a burden, that makes their job even harder to lobby for full amnesty. So at every turn, every time anybody has ever tried to actually do something about our broken borders, the left in this country has actively opposed it. But there's an opportunity, as I said, over and over and over again right now to fix this comprehensively. Here's comprehensive immigration reform where everybody can get something that they want as long as we're operating honestly. But honestly, I suspect that what the left wants is amnesty only, that the only thing that they really want is amnesty. And I seriously question how committed many members of the Republican Party in power are to border enforcement as well. Because as you know, Ira, there has always been a rear guard, a subterranean action going on in the Republican Party, which is the Chamber of Commerce Republicans who want cheap labor, who want to insource cheap workers for the jobs they can't outsource, the driveway pavers and the hotel chambermaids and the Country Club Owners Association that wants cheap landscapers, et cetera, et cetera. The meatpacking and poultry industry, all of those industries that employ large numbers of undocumented laborers that cheapen labor, and they want to make sure that they keep that supply of labor coming in, the H-1B visa violators, et cetera. So I don't know who Trump is listening to, but he's got to lay out a comprehensive immigration reform package that starts with border security before amnesty. Otherwise, we'll be right back having the same conversation again.
You're absolutely right. The Republican leadership doesn't really want this. Nobody's quite clear what Trump wants or doesn't want. But the fact is, the Republicans control the government these days. They control the White House. They control both houses of Congress. They need to tell the Democrats, here's what we want, and do it publicly, and then force Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to explain why they don't want border security, why they don't want E-Verify to protect American jobs. Put them in a position where they have to defend the indefensible. They've had plenty of opportunities to do this in the past on a lot of issues, and they have never done it. And it, you know, indicates that they are listening to what the Chamber of Commerce is saying, that they don't really want to do it, but they just don't want to take the heat for, taking an amnesty without getting anything in return, so that they pretend like they're for all these things, but they never actually do them because they're listening to other people.
Ira, as always, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. FairUS.org, FairUS.org. There's been a lot of damage done on college campuses and other areas, including Washington, D.C., the day that Donald Trump took the oath of office with counter-protesters. A group that calls itself Antifa is now possibly going to be classified as a street gang under California law. And to talk about this is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino, Brian Levin. Brian, welcome aboard. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. And can I tell you something? A friend of mine said you're the second best radio personality in Southern California. That friend was Pete Tilden.
Oh, God. What does he know?
I'm just kidding. He never said that.
No, no kidding. There's no way he said anything nice to me because, you know, we have a feud going. I was thinking on the day that Boomer's Esiason's partner got arrested in New York talk radio, I figure, well, maybe I'm running a close second to that guy. anyway, listen, thanks for coming on with us, Brian. And this is this is a significant story because, you know, we've had some experience with left-wing extremist groups on the immigration issue, which is a very emotional issue. We get it. Back at our old building, we had protesters out there who were using these tactics of ski masks. And this was the tactic that we experienced firsthand. Women and children in the front, guys with ski masks behind them with cameras, and then behind them, other guys in ski masks and headscarves with frozen soda bottles and water bottles and rocks sometimes. They would throw them over the heads of everybody. And when the cops would come through, they would get videotape of cops coming through women and children. And that would be the video that would be marketed as examples of how ruthless and brutal the police are and society is. And that's one small example of the kind of, you know, tactics that have been out there. But it's basically my rule of thumb that if you're bringing a ski mask to hide your face from a protest, you're not engaged in a peaceful protest, or you're not planning on a peaceful protest if you have to hide your face.
Unless you look like me.
Well, that's it. Or in radio. Yes, granted. but I mean, you know, the civil rights marchers, people walking over the Edmund Pettus Bridge did not have to cover their faces.
Sure. You know, and you make some really interesting points. Here's what I think is a big issue. Let's stipulate, and nobody would stipulate this more than me, I intervened to protect a Klansman who was getting beaten in Anaheim, and believe me, I find those folks loathsome. Here's the issue, though. First, is there a set of chapters, let's say that they are segments of Antifa, that disguise themselves and come looking for fights? By the way, on the hard right and the alt right, there are folks who are armed and looking for battle too. In fact,
sure,
the only two homicides that we've seen at these types of rallies have been committed by alt-right partisans. That being said, here's the issue that I have. I certainly contend that there is a significant segment of Antifa that is both violent and also anti our institutions and processes of our democracy. And they believe that hate speech is violence and part of an oppressive lever of a systemic oppression to vulnerable people and all that. Here's the thing. The gang statute really focuses on more organized entities. So here's what I'm afraid of. Somebody comes to a protest, they're generally peaceful, something happens, they get caught up in something, and then someone with no criminal record, no intent to commit violence, ends up getting lumped in with this actual segment, which is violent and somewhat organized, and then they get a significant penalty enhancement. I've seen prosecutors use the gang enhancement in instances where I didn't feel that it was appropriate. And that's what I worry about. Not that technically, are there Antifa chapters that are violent and engage in a systemic rollout of violence, particularly at these demonstrations? Yes. What I worry about is, you know, Antifa is one of those things that's so broad that within that scope, there are people who are more confrontational than they are violent. Although the movement at its core, and I think this is important, says violence is either tolerable in certain instances for defensive purposes, or it's
desirable,
embraced.
Yes.
Or it's embraced, and not that I think that beating up neo-Nazis is appropriate anyway, but within the hardened core of Antifa, their definition of fascists extends to you, journalists, sometimes innocent bystanders.
Well, anybody,
Trump supporters.
Anybody who doesn't march to their, I mean, they are, the irony is that they're left-wing fascists. They are people whose real objective is the toppling of America as we know it. They don't like capitalism. Is it, under different names, is it the same people that have shown up at G8 summit meetings that caused disturbances at Occupy Wall Street gatherings? And it's the problem of modern America and the technology. The digital world makes it possible for people to have flash mobs show up at places and for the sort of parasites to show up and commingle and cause trouble. And then it brings disrepute to the entire crowd. And that's why I think it's so important for the right and the left to have an honest house cleansing and to aggressively and emphatically distance themselves from the kooks that would attach themselves onto their movements.
Doug, let me just hit one thing, and this is unfortunately what happens when you get a professor on. Fascism refers generally to a dictatorship that is immersed in nationalism, oftentimes and particularly racial. So whatever you want to call these guys on the left, I would call them actually something different. And many people would say they're not left, that they're anarchists. But here's my worry. And again, please don't send emails saying I'm defending Antifa. The hardcore of those, they're violent. They are against the institutions and processes of our democracy. And I condemn that root and branch. But anarchists are much more disorganized, if you will. So part of this discussion relates to not, you know, are the people at the hardest core of this violence and doing things that are unethical and immoral? Yes, absolutely. But it's a spectrum, and at the other end of the spectrum are people who are not wedded to necessarily destroying our institutions and our processes, and they call themselves anti-fascists. It's really difficult when you define yourself about with regard to what you're against as opposed to what you're for.
Well, yeah, I also think that we can get lost in a cul-de-sac here of overanalyzing. The bottom line is I'm not using the term fascism in a literal sense. I'm just saying that thugs wearing ski masks, throwing buckets of urine on cops, are using
brown shirt tactics that we saw in the beer garden putsch of Germany in the 1920s and 30s in modern America in 2017. So they can call themselves whatever they want, but the bottom line is that this is thuggery masquerading as some kind of social justice warrior behavior, and it's nothing of the sort.
I agree with you on that, but in my business, this cul-de-sac is where I live. In other words, what I mean is when we pass a law or label a particular entity as a street gang, that has not only technical aspects but operational aspects that might actually get people who don't buy into this horrible thuggery stuff and this terrible ideology.
Got it. Yeah, that's a good point.
And they get kind of swept up and then get an additional 5 or 10 years in prison.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem, by the way, of adjudicating speech as a crime. And I support hate speech crime enhancements because to me there is a difference between, for instance, graffiti, spray painting, you know, Kilroy was here on the side of someone's garage, and spraying the N-word on the side of a garage of the only black family living in a neighborhood. There's a level of personalization and intent. So I get that, but there are shades of gray here that are dangerous because once you start prosecuting people with extra enhancements because of things that they've said, now you're getting perilously close to criminalizing speech and literally violating the First Amendment, where the government is dictating what can and can't be said with the force of law behind it.
And let me just give you another example. We're nonpartisan. The overwhelming majority of people in the pro-life movement are peaceful.
Right.
So what I'm saying is, in the same way that if there were violent people, and there certainly are, but they're very small, if there were both peaceful people and violent people, I wouldn't want, for instance, the swath of the law punishing peaceful pro-life demonstrators as much as I wouldn't want that swath going against anti-racist folks. So that's my only technicality. But that being said, look, some of these chapters of Antifa are, in fact, quite violent, and they engage in group behavior over time with a pattern of criminality. So, you know, so in the technical sense, are there folks who would, I think, properly come under that rubric? Yes. But you know what? I'm also very concerned about giving the government a lot of power with respect to dissent as opposed to criminality.
All right. Fair enough. Good call. Thank you for being with us, Brian. Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino. Appreciate you being with us. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.